I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now in Denver as the spotlight moves from the Pepsi Center over to the Invesco Mile High Stadium, and yesterday began moving from Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama.
I am here today to release you as my delegates. Now,
no.
It's closure, but it is tough.
I move Senator Barack Obama of Illinois be selected by this convention by acclamation as the nominee of the Democratic Party for President of the United States.
All in favor of the motion to suspend the rules and nominate by acclamation Barack Obama as the Democratic Party's presidential candidate, please say aye.
I am happy. This is historic. I am a child of the 60s. This is the culmination of every dream I ever had.
Hello, Democrats!
Barack Obama making a surprise stage appearance here at the Pepsi Center last night after an extraordinary day. We were there in a convention center ballroom as Hillary Clinton released her many disappointed delegates. Then back at the Pepsi Center during the roll call, she acclaimed him the nominee. Tonight, he'll accept that nomination before more than 70,000 people at Mile High Stadium in front of a set of specially built Greek columns. Already the McCain campaign is mocking the backdrop, calling it the Temple of Obama. Well, Rick Klein is here, senior political reporter for ABC News. And Rick, the columns, the stadium, what are the risks?
They're considerable for the Obama campaign. It plays into a narrative that the McCain campaign has been pushing of Obama being presumptuous. They talk about the seal that he had at one of his events a while back, and the fact that he went abroad and had a couple hundred thousand people in Berlin cheering him on. So the fact that he'll have 75,000 people, he'll be appearing in front of columns, those are things that the Obama campaign is trying to minimize the risks around. They're playing with some camera angles, some shots to try to make it appear that he's with people and not in his own little palace.
Because it also plays into the Republican phrase, the Messiah, that you hear so
the one,
often.
Yes.
But the question at the beginning of the week was, will the West be won? And you say that, you know, the stadium goes a little bit towards that.
It does. They about two-thirds of the tickets have gone to residents of Western states. About half of that number just in Colorado alone, which is an important battleground state. But this is really the future of the Democratic Party. When you look at states like New Mexico, Nevada, maybe even Arizona, you go up into the Big Sky country of Montana and South Dakota, North Dakota. These are states that could potentially be in play. Democrats are looking here rather than in some of the traditional battlegrounds of the South.
Right. Well, and I'm looking, I've got the today's Denver Post here. And, you know, here's their conclusion, or at least one article at the end of the week, wanting to hear more of Obama. They talked to people in the Sloan Lake neighborhood, predominantly Democratic, and they say they just haven't heard about plans for the economy, for reducing oil dependence, immigration issues. This was a Hillary Clinton convention.
It was. We consumed about 3 days with Hillary Obama drama instead of looking just at Barack Obama and his record and what he wants to do. You had the arrival day, you had Hillary's speech, you had the big roll call vote, you had Bill's speech last night. Tonight is the night that Barack Obama has to take ownership of this convention, has to take ownership of the party. There has been a handing of the baton. The torch has been passed, and he has to claim it. He has to do it in a big way tonight.
Yeah, and we just want to take a look ahead because we're headed to St. Paul, as you are as well. Now, John McCain said today he's yet to decide on his running mate. Is that possible?
I don't think anyone really believes that. Certainly he has a very strong inclination at this point, and he has informed, we understand, some of his top advisors of who that is, although he has not, we don't believe, reached out to his selection yet. There's only a handful of names seriously in the mix. Mitt Romney, Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota.
Who, by the way, I just want to jump in to say, Tim Pawlenty is saying today that if you turn off the teleprompter, there's nothing there, and that's regarding Barack Obama. So he was sort of sent out, what would you call this, the vice presidential audition?
Yeah, it is an audition of sorts. Mitt Romney was here earlier in the week. Pawlenty's there now in Denver to now doing the rapid response for the Republicans. It is something of an audition, but we're going to get a selection from John McCain very shortly. We're expecting by tomorrow at the latest, and that means very little bump for Obama. By tomorrow, we'll be talking about the Republicans, about this newly minted ticket, as well as the convention.
Well, actually, we should say there are a couple of reports today that the McCain VP pick might actually be leaked tonight at 6 and then confirmed at 8, as opposed to the 11 o'clock appearance that he has in Dayton tomorrow, Dayton, Ohio. By then, he may have the VP by his side. Well, we just want to ask, McCain praised a former Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge this morning. Ridge is for abortion rights, as is independent Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman. Are any of them really contenders, considering how contentious that issue is with the base?
This would split the party open at the worst possible time. We'd be talking about the abortion issue, just like we talked about the Hillary issue right now, and there could even be a fight on the convention floor. I'm not sure John McCain wants to risk that, wants to provoke that, given how close this race is right now. He can't afford to alienate any portion of his base.
Yeah. And Rick Klein, you know, do you think that right about now the American electorate is starting to pay attention?
I hope so. You know, it's amazing to me that it's taken this long in some ways because we follow it so closely. But the bottom line is the conventions are the traditional kickoff to the campaign. We're going to run into Labor Day next week. That's the other marking point. So people will be paying attention. The conventions are a big opportunity to showcase what you want to show about a candidate. And now the sprint is on.
Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News. So nice to see you in person.
Likewise. It's
been
fun.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Well, Barack Obama will accept the Democratic presidential nomination tonight on the 45th anniversary of the March on Washington, the day the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech.
I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream.
Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton of the District of Columbia is one of maybe only five people who are here at the convention in Denver who were there with King, working as a young civil rights lawyer in Mississippi. Now she's here to watch another moment in history and joins us. Congresswoman, remind us of that day 45 years ago.
I had spent part of the summer working for the March on Washington under Bayard Rustin. And at the end, he said to the staff, who wants to remain here for people who call in about bus rides late? And my hand went straight up in the air because I knew that I would get to fly over the march as it was forming.
Because you'd be flying in from, what, New York?
I'd be flying in from New York. Mm-hmm. I stayed all night in the march headquarters in Harlem. And then I got in a plane, and the most thrilling sight of my life, I saw as the plane swooped into Washington, my hometown, by the way, and you could see the march forming and all the doubts about whether they would come and what would happen just floated away into the clouds that we were coming through.
Because today, it's not that it's predictable that people will turn out for marches, but we've seen many since. This was sort of a will they come. And they came.
No one could remember when large numbers of people had gathered for a protest march in Washington. There had been marches, you know, with veterans who wanted to claim their benefits. But no one could remember a crowd of this size, and we didn't know what the size would be. It turned out to be about 250,000. When that number came, it just blew the socks off of official Washington and began what was clearly the impetus for the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and 1965 Voting Rights Act.
And you were there at that speech. And tell us about the speech.
I sure was, because I was a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and we were back of the stage, as it were, you know, right near where Lincoln was sitting. The view I had on the march was not of Martin Luther King, but it was of watching the crowd. And then for the rest of the march, I just looked out there and I heard Martin Luther King bellowing what seemed to me these words just ringing in my ears, these unbelievable words, words of the kind I had never heard.
Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Remember, we're talking 1963, and we're talking about the post-McCarthy era, the era of great silence and where people speaking out on issues that were unpopular were shunned. And so it wasn't exactly the age of protest, and the protest came from the South. Here we're bringing it to Washington. Montgomery bus boycott was held in the South, in the heart of the South. The sit-ins by that time had taken place in the heart of the South. But hey, what are you doing in Washington? This is the capital of the United States. We don't do that here.
I'm reminded in talking to you that earlier this week we spoke to Lawrence Guyot, the activist from Mississippi. I know you know him very well, and you also worked with Fannie Lou Hamer, the former sharecropper who led the fight for blacks to be delegates from Mississippi, went to the Democratic Convention in 64. They only offered her two seats. She refused it. You know, we didn't come all this way for two seats. She was your mentor. She wouldn't have seen it that way. But
she never would have seen it that way because I had a law degree, but I met her the right way. I got her out of jail the first day I got to the Mississippi Delta, and we formed this, we bonded immediately.
How old were you, if you don't mind my asking?
I don't know, my early 20s somehow. And, well, I was still in law school.
And you're bailing out this, I think she was in her 40s at the time.
Oh, this could have been my mother.
Yeah. And she, what did you see when she came out? She had
been beat very badly. Guyot had been beat so bad that he didn't have any clothes on. And when they told him that someone was here, he had to put some clothes on. I mean, that's just how badly he had been treated. And that was the summer of 63. All these things sort of come together. Mm-hmm. In 64, I had just graduated from law school, and Ms. Hamer and Guyot were leading the Mississippi Freedom Democrats. And I was one of the lawyers on the brief for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and ran the lobbying operation to try to get people to seat our delegation, not the official racist Mississippi delegation.
The alternate.
Yes.
You and Fannie Lou Hamer and others go to the Democratic Convention. She makes the plea to be seated, only gets the two seats, rejects it, and then in 68, she returns as a delegate with Lawrence Guyot and others. I'm wondering, when we spoke with Lawrence Guyot, he says he draws a direct line from the martyrs of the early 60s, to what's happening this week.
I don't see how you could fail to do that. For example, this week you see a completely transformed Democratic Party, a party that decided, based on what happened in the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party delegation, that delegations would be reflective of the diversity of our country. Even the Republicans have changed somewhat because of what happened in 64. When you get to the point where you not only now have the kind of a convention we have, which is fully representative of the country, but have a standard bearer whom we never dreamed of having, then it is impossible to say because we didn't dream it, the line doesn't come from there. The first to say that it did would be Barack Obama.
Eleanor Holmes Norton, Congresswoman from the District of Columbia. When we come back, her thoughts about today. Is there a generational rift in African-American leadership? We heard Jesse Jackson Jr. rebuke his father when the elder Jackson criticized Barack Obama. Her thoughts also about today, whatever your political stripe, an historic day. Also later, the voices of protest outside the Pepsi Center where we are. We'll be back in 1 minute here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
The District of Columbia, the capital of the great United States of America.
During last night's roll call, Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton reminded Democrats of Washington, D.C.'s fight for statehood and full representation in Congress, something she calls the country's oldest civil rights struggle. Then she cast D.C.'s votes.
33 votes for the co-sponsor of the D.C. Voting Rights Act, the next president of the United States, Barack Obama.
We're back with more of our conversation with Eleanor Holmes Norton. And Eleanor, on this day when Obama accepts his party's nomination, we remember early on in his campaign there were questions about whether, as it was put at the time, Barack Obama was black enough. He is biracial, but was born and raised in Hawaii and Indonesia. He wasn't with you or Dr. King or former sharecropper Fannie Lou Hamer, who was so severely beaten in the 60s. And that question about his blackness was said to expose a generational rift in African-American leadership between, you know, Jesse Jackson and his son, between, you know, some of the older people who walked with you and the younger people who wanted to move on and not look back. Now there's a look on your face that I wish I could describe for radio, but...
people who go around speaking for us about who's black enough better watch out, because we'll decide that ourselves. In fact, we call ourselves African Americans. Look at this guy. He's a real African. We pretend that we are Africans. He knows who his African ancestors were. We adopt these African names from the continent, but he's awfully black. He comes from the mother country, or at least his forebears did. And the notion of a rift between the generations could not be more absurd. The younger generation over-idolizes us. Jesse Jackson idolizes his father. The fact that he has a different take on some things should not be mistaken for a different take on blacks or on where we are in this country. No, the generation that's coming has the benefits that we struggle for, and they know it. Sometimes they envy the notion that they don't have to struggle. They want to be in marches. They want to struggle, and we love that. And people in my generation are not only passing the baton, they're throwing the baton at the younger generation. We see it in the Congressional Black Caucus, where we're getting younger and younger members. We also see more diversity in the caucus. We see that they're coming from more conservative districts, southern districts. We don't expect them to vote the same way we do. So the whole point was to take us past the stereotype of three or four black people in Congress who came from solidly black districts, so you knew exactly how they thought. Hey, that was never true of them, but it's particularly not true now when we come from an array of districts. Many of us come from districts which are not even majority black.
You were, in addition to being a civil rights worker, very much a feminist and very much involved in women's issues, and you're well aware of the disappointed Hillary Clinton voters. I'm sorry, it's the cliched question of the week. Is the party going to heal that wound between the women who feel, and older women in many cases, who feel they were sort of pushed aside? Your thoughts as someone who's very much involved in women's issues as well?
When my constituents wanted to know who was I for, I said, well, you can bet your bottom dollar I'm going to decide on the merits, because I can't decide on gender identification, because I don't know which me to stand up, the feminist or the black militant. I'm not going to give either of those away. I must say, the polls have shown that women are in Barack's camp, and I think that the focus is justifiable on a very small group of women who feel much as I think African Americans would if Barack had not, in fact, achieved the nomination. And we wouldn't have gone away mad, we who voted for white people and only white people for most of our time in this country. But if Barack hadn't gotten it, we would also have had people who would never get over it. So how can I do anything but sympathize with women who, in fact, feel disappointed? The only problem I would have with them is if they did not reconcile themselves to the democratic process the way Hillary has, and particularly since the nominee is an African-American, and there has been the strongest of coalitions between black people and women seeking equal rights for everybody. So the last thing we need is to have a few people in that coalition look as though they're not happy that an African-American won.
Well, just as we let you go, we began by asking, on this, the anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, your memories. And now I'm wondering, in this historic moment, if you'll be thinking of some of those figures, the people who aren't here with us anymore.
I'll be thinking first and foremost of the people who made it possible. First, Martin Luther King Jr. You know, Martin Luther King was a very young man, when this began in his late 20s. So he could easily have lived to see this day if he'd not been assassinated. I think of Coretta, who gave her life to the movement and who died just a few years ago. And I'll think of my own mentor, Fannie Lou Hamer, who died of cancer at least 20 years ago, but died after not only fulfilling her own legacy about racial harmony, but died after seeing her native Sunflower County declare Fannie Lou Hamer Day. These are the people who put her off the plantation. And in the end, she ended up starting a pig farm so that the poor white people and the poor people would have meat. And they loved her for it. So if ever anybody needed to be sitting front and center, those are the three people I would choose.
Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton of the District of Columbia, on an obviously emotional day. Thank you. We'll be back with more from Denver after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now, and the clock in Denver is counting down to the most anticipated of the week's many anticipated moments, Barack Obama's acceptance speech tonight at the Mile High Stadium. We are here at the Pepsi Center, which they're breaking down even as we speak. I expect to be carted off any moment now. Everybody's moving over to Invesco. And almost as soon as Obama's speech is delivered, the words will enter the annals of history and be compared to other speeches, not the least of which the Martin Luther King Jr. I Have a Dream speech that we spoke of earlier today. Talk about pressure. Well, we want to turn to one of our favorite historians to put this moment in context and to look ahead to tonight. Julian Zelitzer joins us from our studios in Boston. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a contributor to the Huffington Post and Politico.com. Julian, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
They seriously might just, you know, I might be rolling out of here within moments, so bear with us. They really are breaking down here, and analysts like yourself are also sort of breaking down the week, you know. So, first of all, how do you think the convention went?
It's been okay. I don't think it's been terrific. I thought Hillary Clinton's speech was one of the toughest and probably the most exciting, but many of them have been quite tame. I mean, Democrats have a history of being a little bit tame at these conventions ever since 1968, and I think they're showing that again this week.
Well, you know, we know 68 and, you know, anything but tame. But, you know, what are some comparable historic conventions? And did they feel historic when they were happening?
Often they don't. I mean, often these speeches and the conventions themselves feel historic after. I think there was a little excitement of John F. Kennedy in 1960. He had some of the same kind of charisma that we see with Barack Obama and built the same kind of excitement with younger Democrats. So there was a bit of that, although he wasn't even sure he was going to win going into the convention. Bill Clinton in 92, interesting to look back and see that he said many of the same kind of messages as Barack Obama probably will tonight.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Let's stay there, because there are eerie parallels between not just his acceptance speech, but their lives. We're looking at his acceptance speech. Remember the lines, "We can do it, we can do it, we can do it." And, of course, you have with Barack Obama, "Yes, we can." And then you have their stories, absentee fathers, raised by mothers, in poverty. Or near poverty. Tell us more your thoughts on the comparison.
It is striking. I mean, we've stressed the differences between Clinton and Barack Obama for obvious reasons in this contest, but in many ways there were similarities. I mean, both came from a certain personal background of struggle, of hardship, that I think has made both of them compelling figures for many Democrats, that they were different than what we at least associate Republicans with. Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I mean, the Democrats are always very good at positioning themselves as the party of average working and middle class Americans. So the biography of both of these men, I think, is important in terms of how they are going to sell themselves in this case and how Clinton sold himself back in 92.
Well, and it seems especially important, Julian, this time around. We've been saying this a lot, but I think it's worth repeating. You know, we've been out and around in the area around Denver. People do not know Barack Obama. They have told us they think he is a Muslim. They don't think he was born in the United States. They're convinced he wasn't. Of course, I know the dangers in even repeating the false perception that spread it, but this is what they think, that, and it is not true, but what can he do tonight to counter that?
I would just add, even the whole argument of him being an elite, coming from an elite background, contradicts his actual upbringing. I think it's important in this message tonight, in the speech, he doesn't just focus on the Bush administration, like many people want him to do. I think he has to speak about himself. I think he has to take it upon himself to define who he is, what his story is, and what his policies will be. Because in August, Republicans have done a good job of doing that for him. And so far in the convention, I haven't heard a lot about Barack Obama. And so I think in this speech, it's very important that he almost gives us a short autobiography and introduces Americans to who he's going to be in the next few months and who he would be as president.
I can't tell you how many times we hear, is he going to care about middle class? Is he going to care about the middle class? We hear that over and over again, as if he's not, he actually began below the middle class and maybe passed a little bit through it just recently. So obviously that he needs to hit on that. We should say we're going to be in St. Paul next week. The Republicans will say they have a story to tell as well. The first POW presidential candidate. I just wonder, if you, by the way, want to look forward to that.
Yeah, no, I think, look, with John McCain, it's a more known quantity, and I think Republicans have a little bit of an easier time in that Americans know the story of John McCain. He's more familiar as a political figure. So in some ways, they have a little more flexibility next week to just go after the Democrats, whereas Democrats this week have almost a two-step process. But I think we're going to hear a lot about national security, and we're going to hear a lot about tax cuts. It's two themes that have worked for Republicans politically, and John McCain has given every signal that's really where he's going to attack Barack Obama.
I mean, it's a slippery slope because he has a very appealing to many personal story, but the Republicans are already saying, the Republican Party has released a statement saying that the convention has been a mile high and an inch deep. So to concentrate on the personal stories, it's the walking the fine line, it would seem, between doing the personal stories but also the policy.
Yeah, the Republican job will be to separate John McCain from George Bush, even with a group of Republicans. I mean, that's clearly his greatest vulnerability. So he's going to have to spend some time outlining if he supports the war in Iraq and if he supports a similar set of economic policies, challenging what Bill Clinton said last night, explaining how will this be a different administration. I think that's John McCain's biggest task.
Yeah, you wrote recently about Joe Biden, and I do want to touch on the vice presidential candidate. Very emotional night last night, introduced by his son, the son who, along with another son, survived a terrible car crash in which Joe Biden's first wife and infant daughter died. He also has a powerful story.
Yeah, and it's one most people don't know. I mean, he comes across as the traditional elite senator in Washington, almost a caricature, of what you would want if you were a Republican. But in fact, the story is incredibly compelling, both from the tragedy he suffered, but also his own upbringing, the fact he's very poor or modest by Senate standards, and the kind of town he's lived in and came from. And so I think that was an important part of last night, explaining who Joe Biden is and why Barack Obama found that story important and why it might resonate with voters in places like Pennsylvania. He didn't do as much on national security. I mean, that's where Biden is very strong. He takes on Republicans like almost no other Democrat I've seen in recent years on foreign policy. He didn't do as much yet, but I assume that's going to be coming.
So, Julian Zelitzer, as this convention is going into the history books, Michael Barone, sometimes called the Dean of the Washington Press Corps, writes that he thinks this has been the edgiest convention in a generation, meaning all the tension. But as we've been saying, the Democrats have seen more tense ones in 80 when Kennedy and Carter were, fighting, as you said, to the last minute, or the convention of 1924, which took 10 days and 103 ballots before nominating the completely obscure John Davis. So, I know you're still sifting through it, but, people here who were here in the room have been blown away, not just by the emotional moments, but by the city of Denver. Just in the few seconds we have, you say what about this convention?
I think there's a historic event that took place, but the convention itself is actually remarkably normal, given the historic candidate they have.
Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, contributor to the Huffington Post and Politico.com, and always welcome here at Here and Now. Julian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And before we go today, the youngest superdelegate here in Denver, you're listening to Here and Now. Rage Against the Machine headlined the 10th State Music Festival to end the war at the Denver Coliseum yesterday. After the concert, band members led thousands on a more than three-mile march to the Pepsi Center last night. Earlier in the week, about 100 protesters from the group Recreate 68 were arrested in a clash with police. And there have been dozens of small individual protests against the DNC's pro-choice stance.
A vote for Obama is a vote for dead babies.
Against the current president.
When the president talks to God, does he ever think that maybe he's not?
And on the 16th Street Pedestrian Mall, we ran into someone against everyone.
You have a hockey stick with a sign on it. What does it say?
Reads, lesser of evils again, and I want a better choice. I just have great faith that there's a candidate out there that can cross the party lines, you know, not Democratic, not Republican, just, you know, an American. I can just bring this nation back.
Bobby Orr? With the hockey stick?
Maybe. You know, Nick Lindstrom, who knows? But, yeah, I got to hope that there's somebody out there that's better than what we're being offered. I listened to Hillary. She said, you know, not McCain, you know, not McCain. It's like, okay, so we're going to vote for Obama because he's the lesser of evils? What? I mean, you know, he's the better choice out there. He's going to hurt me the least. I mean, I'd like to find someone that's not really going to hurt me much at all.
A political convention is a time for Americans to take a stand and for movements to take stock. At the huge media party earlier this week, we bumped into Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the anti-war group Code Pink. I wondered if she noted that the media party could also be called the largest gathering ever of people who hadn't covered her early anti-war protests.
I do, and I think about how they not only didn't cover the anti-war movement, they were embedded with the military. They sold the Pentagon line. They're doing a little bit better job, some of them, in terms of talking about Iran, but not much better covering the real news.
Of course, I'm the one holding the microphone, so what do you want to say this week?
Well, we're here to say that we thought that when the Democrats took over the Congress, they were actually going to do what the people voted them in to do, which is cut the funding for the war and hold the Bush administration accountable for taking us into this war. And they didn't do that. They joined in the continuing of eroding of our civil liberties. And we're very unhappy with them. So we're here to say that they've done a really lousy job so far, that they better do a better job, and that we're watching.
Or what? You know, I mean, Barack Obama's the candidate. He voted for the surveillance bill. So what leverage do you have?
We have the leverage of being out on the streets, of organizing people. In September, we're going to knock on a million doors and say, express your desire to end the war now. We're going to use the election period to be dogging not only the presidential candidates, but all of the congressional people running for office again. Whenever they appear publicly in town hall meetings and press conferences, as well as when they're home in their districts, to be pushing this message about how we want them to do what we voted them in to do. So, yeah, we don't have a hell of a lot of leverage because it's a two-party winner-take-all system in this country. But, hey, we got the democracy that we've been handed, and we're doing our best within those obstacles.
But what about the fact that, in fact, the Bush administration is using a word like timeline, timetable, time horizon, talking about withdrawal of troops?
The discourse has totally changed, and I think we should take some inspiration from the fact that we've managed to help change that discourse, that they are not only talking about timeline, they're starting to put it in the status of forces agreement. And I also think that we have played a major role in stopping us from going to war with Iran. There's still a great possibility that that might happen, but that we've managed to turn public opinion as well against going into another war is a positive thing. So I think there are some things that we have accomplished as a peace movement. I don't think Barack Obama would have beat Hillary Clinton if it were not for our efforts to show Hillary Clinton as somebody who not only voted for the war, but was unrepentant in her vote for the war. So we haven't ended the war, but we've influenced public opinion, which does have an influence on the political system.
Code Pink anti-war activist Medea Benjamin. Well, coming up, Denver's youngest superdelegate, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. All week, we've been bringing you the sounds of the Democratic Convention here in Denver, and I'm willing to bet it's one of the first conventions to host Kenyan gymnasts. The group Mapapo Kenyan Acrobats, extraordinary self-taught tumblers, have been touring in the U.S. They told us they were very proud that the Democratic nominee's father came from Kenya, but they were more interested in the fact that he came from a poor background and made good.
If you're born rich, you don't know the pain the poor get, you know? You don't know about them, but if you born poor and become rich, you know what's going on. You can fix that thing. If at home, they're happy too. You know, like, they can fix things there too.
Oh, so you're saying that if Barack Obama, if he succeeds here, it helps your people at home?
Yeah, you know, like, he help everywhere, you know, in the idea. You know, you go to school, you come, they have nothing there, but you still go to school because you got that hope. One day, you will be somebody.
The Mupapo Kenyan Acrobats in Denver earlier this week. Well, candidate Barack Obama has, we know, also inspired young people here in the U.S. This year, there are 631 delegates under 36, nearly double the percentage of seats younger delegates held back in 2000. And the number of young people who voted in the primaries this year was nearly double compared to 8 years ago. Well, at 21, Jason Ray is the youngest superdelegate at the convention. He's also the co-chair of the DNC Youth Council. He's skipping his first week of senior year classes at Marquette University in Wisconsin to be here. We caught up with him in between meetings and caucuses down the street at the Colorado Convention Center to ask when he first got bit by the political bug.
I mean, I remember back in kindergarten asking my parents to vote for Bill Clinton when I was only 5 years old. There's always been something inside of me that has just drawn me to politics. And back when I was 17, I decided to take a run for the Democratic National Committee from Wisconsin. This was June of 2004. Ended up getting elected, and through that have stayed extremely involved.
Well, hold on. How does one get elected? I mean, did you go door to door? What did you do?
We are elected to the DNC in Wisconsin from the delegates to our state party convention. So we had about 600 to 700 delegates gathered. I think it was in Appleton, Wisconsin. I stood at the convention hall door. I shook hands. I handed out flyers. I made phone calls beforehand, sent out emails, and just worked to shore up support and just ask people for their vote. I was running on this slogan of representing America's next generation of voters, and that was a message that really resonated with the delegates.
Well, plus, you're 21 now. You're doing this when you're 17. You still look about 12.
I do.
So it must have really impressed people.
It did. I mean, I was campaigning against the president of the state's firefighter union and also against the state legislator. I wasn't supposed to beat either of them. But I ended up coming in first in the race. And, you know, I the whole reason I ran and got involved in politics was I wanted to increase opportunities for young people. I wanted to make sure that when party decisions are being made, when they are electing candidates, that they think about what young people want, that they make sure when they're writing platforms that they include issues that are relevant to young people.
Well, what are they?
I think the real issues are issues that are cross-generational. I think healthcare, education.
When I was 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, I mean, I thought about my health, but I never thought about healthcare. Do you think young people, I mean, their parents, if they have it, pay for it?
Not. Most students are worried about, as soon as they graduate, what are they going to do? Most of my classmates fall off of their parents' insurance plans as soon as they quit being a full-time student. For those who aren't able to get a job right away, those who have to work part-time jobs, they can't pay the co-pays. They can't make all their payments. If they're worried if they get sick during that, you know, even if it's a two-week period, if they get sick and need to go to the hospital, that they're going to find themselves in debt for years to come. And I think it's just a matter of how you talk about health care. The reason I joined the Democratic Party was as I was comparing the parties and looking at platforms, and I saw that the vision that I had for the country way back in elementary school was the same, you know, idea that they were promoting.
And hold on a second. Am I being campaigned right now?
You are not being campaigned. I am not running for office for anything right now. I don't know that I will anytime soon. But
in a half hour, you might.
I'm so busy today. My schedule has me booked. So Wait until Friday and we'll see what happens.
So here you are so excited. What's the disconnect? Why is it that not even 20% of eligible young people vote?
You know, I think we have seen the number of young people voting increase. From 2000 to 2004, it increased. We saw it increase during all the primaries this year. I think every state, the number of young people either doubled, tripled, and in some areas quadrupled. And I think young people are going to be voting in record numbers this fall. I don't see a disconnect. I think young people are realizing that they have an opportunity to shape the direction of this country.
Well, but you know what the Republicans are saying? That's so great that young people help give them the nomination because they predict that even if they come out in larger numbers than ever before, it won't be enough.
No, not this time, because young people don't normally vote in primaries. They'll vote in a general election. They'll vote in a big presidential. But primaries are not normally something that people turn out for. We saw states where their young voters quadrupled. It's places like that that you know that young people are turning out because they are now almost a bigger voting bloc than the seniors.
Now, I understand early on in the campaigns, we read about you because both the campaigns, the Obama and the Clinton, tried to woo you. How far did they go?
I mean, I had breakfast with Chelsea Clinton one morning. I had a phone call from President Clinton. I met with Michelle Obama, met with Senator Obama, and had a great opportunity to get to know both candidates and really see their vision for this country.
What are you thinking when, and I hear Chelsea Clinton flew in to see you. What are you thinking when you hear that?
I mean, she came to town, she was campaigning, and it was just one of her many stops on a busy day of campaign events. But,
yeah, but you're 21.
I am 21, and it shows that young voters have a say in this process, and that's what I wanted to tell people, that, you know, the superdelegates who were out there were not party insiders sitting in a back room making decisions. They were party activists like myself who are spending our time campaigning, are working for candidates, are volunteering, are doing everything we can to get Democrats elected up and down the ballot.
Which did you go for, by the way?
I decided to support Senator Obama.
Here's Chelsea Clinton sitting across the table from you. Was that hard?
It was a very serious decision that I had to sit down and really required thought.
I'm wondering, did you have a little pang watching Hillary Clinton make her speech?
I mean, it was a sad moment. I think Senator Clinton had expected that this was going to be her week, that she would be up there on Thursday night. And you could see that as you could see her tearing up.
Is there something about the party that you hope to change, that you think could be better?
I think we need to increase the number of young people on the DNC. In the past, we've had so few people under the age of 36, and that's what the DNC defines as youth, that I think we need more. I think we need more fresh blood in there coming with new ideas.
And a redefinition of youth, maybe?
The under 36 is what the DNC gives us, so that's what we run with.
We watched a little bit. You're on your cell phone. You've got headquarters set up in your room. But what exactly are you doing?
I am, as a co-chair of the DNC's Youth Council, we have several official meetings and events taking place during the week. Tonight we're sponsoring the official DNC watch party. Yesterday we had a meeting with young candidates. We only have four officers total. We are trying to make sure young people are getting the tickets they need to get into the places. So we are all over trying to do press interviews, trying to make sure the message of youth gets out there. I mean, I start every day at about 6 in the morning, and I'm not done until about 2.
2 in the next morning.
2 the next morning. I do a very long, very long day.
Well, Jason, I'm going to shake your hand because somehow I feel we're going to hear from you again. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jason Ray at 21, the youngest superdelegate here in Denver.
A little bit of back porch, a little bit of swing.
Well, we are getting ready for Barack Obama's speech tonight across the street at Mile High Stadium. But to get an idea of the challenge that lays ahead for Obama, we only had to go to the basement karaoke bar at our hotel, 15 minutes and a world away from Denver. We found a lot of people living the lives they were singing about and not believing the Democrats can help them. We'll have that story for you tomorrow. And then it's on to St. Paul for the Republicans' confab. As they pack up here, our thanks to our technical team here in Denver, Michael LeClaire, Carl Volker, George Hicks, Walter Dixon, and John Davidow as well. My thanks to producers Chris Ballman and Kevin Sullivan. Chris was last seen at the karaoke bar singing Patsy Cline songs. Kevin Sullivan, I believe, has joined the Guam delegation. They've had a lot of fun here this week. Our thanks to the Here Now team back at WBUR in Boston, Lynn Menegon, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Hitesh Hati, and Jill Ryan. Doug Sugars is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Hamad Ahmed, our lone remaining intern, and the senior producer of Here and Now, Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now. A little bit of you loving up on me. A little bit of come on, a little bit of play. A little bit of yee-haw in the house. Thank you.
Yeah. All right, terrific job, Chris. Thank you, buddy. Thank you. Great job. All right, Jim, come on up, Jim.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.